طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where we feature the Palestinian voice speaking out of and to the horror of a stifling Israeli occupation, which is consuming their homeland and perhaps even their culture. But probably not the latter, because of their nonviolent resistance to this occupation, which slowly but steadily is beginning to gain the attention of the international community. We need to amplify their voice, their story, their cause. We need to make visible their humanity in the face of the overwhelming military subjugation by the United States and Israel. We must challenge the U.S.-Israeli narrative of deception, which would have us believe that Israel is the victim here, that black is white, that myth is reality. The Palestinians are up against not only their military and their bulldozers, but their lies and distortion of the truth reflected in their talking points, which are parroted by the mainstream media and believed by a majority of the American people. This Week in Palestine tries to parry the distortions of the Israeli public relations machine with authentic voices that reflect the reality of this occupation. We have two of those authentic voices for you this morning, a journalist and a poet. Because of people like journalist Amira Haas and poet Lisa Majaj, there is hope. As long as there are voices to speak the truth, there is hope. Each of these remarkable women struggled with the use of language to reflect and ultimately challenge the realities of the Israeli occupation as well as the Palestinian resistance. Journalism certainly, and yes, also poetry, have a role to play in the use of language to counter the weapons of destruction that are seemingly consuming Palestinian land. But as long as there are the words of the Amira Hasses and the Lisa Majaj, never their culture. Amira Haas is an Israeli journalist who writes for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. However, she does not live in Israel. She lives in Ramallah, in the West Bank, and also lived 3 years in Gaza because she feels strongly that to cover the occupation, one must live the occupation, and she does. Lisa Majaj has a Palestinian father and an American mother. Born in Iowa, she was raised in Jordan, but spends much time in Palestine where she finds her true identity. Amira Haas and Lisa Majaj spoke at a forum in Boston sponsored by Consequence magazine, where This Week in Palestine recorded their presentations. We begin with Amira Haas, followed by Lisa Majaj.
Good evening, and thank you for inviting me, George, Sarah. Thank you for having me on board. It was not planned, so to tell you the secret. So I thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak here. Usually when I write an article of all sorts, the longest time I spend in looking for the opening, for the opening sentence. So sometimes it will be a half sleepless night, or walking in the morning, and I will look for the opening sentence. And then when I have the opening sentence, it's okay, I can continue. I know how the rest of it will look like. It takes me much less. But thinking about this talk today, I was looking for the right opening sentence, and I could not find. So I will just jump to the second sentence and say that I want to talk about my dilemmas as a journalist, as an Israeli journalist who covers Israeli occupation. And maybe it's enough to say that an Israeli journalist who has been covering the Israeli occupation for the last 25 years. So as I said, 25 years covering the occupation, this is not a compliment, on the contrary. I belong to that school of journalism that hopes or thinks that journalism should trigger a change. And if I say 25 years, it tells for itself where we are. So it's not that I ever was so megalomaniac to think that my writing will create a change, but still there was hope that I and many other, there are some other Israelis who write against the occupation and some papers, and now even more than before, a lot of social media that is concentrated on describing Israeli occupation as a general term. And there are activists, Israeli activists, very devoted, very dedicated, and it's only getting worse. So the general, the Israelis have grown more and more accustomed to this reality. They feel it's normal, they benefit, they profit from it, and they couldn't care less. So it's not a problem of lack of knowledge, on the contrary. There is knowledge, there is information in abundance, but it's just that the average Israeli, and it's the most of them, just couldn't care less, give a damn. So here I am, and this is a real dilemma. Why do I continue if this has failed? So I can say, that's my living, what can I do? That has been, I always say that if I were talented in mathematics or music, I would have preferred to be a mathematician or a musician, but I'm not. There is some sort of habit. I cannot switch to be a reporter for fashion, on fashion affairs. So, in short, I have been drawn into this routine of writing about Israeli domination over the Palestinians. And the subject of this routine is also a routine, because Palestinians, if I want to give one sentence to describe what it is to be a Palestinian under Israeli domination, it is to live in a routine of catastrophes. This is an oxymoron, because we think of catastrophe as one time, but every Palestinian lived and lives now in this routine of catastrophes. And I know, as an Israeli, that not only that every Palestinian was harmed by Israel, by the policies of Israel, by the establishment of Israel, but every Palestinian is also going to be harmed in one way or the other. And this is a terrible thought. So I'm in this routine of covering the routine of catastrophes under which Palestinians live due to the policies of my state, Israel. And routine is the enemy of any media, of any press, because the press, the media, is always looking for new things. And here I am, 25 years, and it's as if I wrote the same, thing that I wrote 25 years ago. Very often something I could write today as well, another confiscation of land, another demolition of a house, another expulsion of a Palestinian from Jerusalem, from the city, etc. And even worse now, because of the internet, it seems that the threshold of interest is always higher, so I always have to climb higher in order to draw the interest of a generally bored readership. So what are my solutions? How do I solve this dilemma? Which are only one of the several. First of all, I pay attention, and here is more stylistic solutions. I pay attention to words. So I will be careful not to use words that are used by power, by the power, the B. I never use the word terror, for example. when I write about any Palestinian who is engaged in armed activity against Israelis, I will never use the terror. It doesn't matter if I to what extent I disapprove of, for example, planting bombs in a bus, but I will not use the term terror. I will not use the term peace process. One of the big lies of the last 25 years. I will write Oslo process, but never, and then explain what a deception it was. But I will never write peace process, that we are engaged in a peace process. I will not use the term Palestinian security control. Because according to the jargon of the U.S. Embassy or the Quartet, Palestinians have military control over around, I don't know, 20% of the West Bank, and used to have in Gaza, I mean, before Hamas and now then. But it's nonsense, because it is not, if they do, if there is anything, they have policing authority. They are allowed to walk, Palestinian policemen are allowed to walk with guns in the enclaves of the West Bank, which comprise around 20%. If they want to go from one enclave to another, through Israeli control, through Israeli full control area, fully controlled area, either they fly or they coordinate with the Israeli army, or they just don't go with the uniforms and weapons. So it is never Palestinian control. Palestinians are not, the PA is not in control. The PA is a subcontractor, the PA is a postman, but it is not in control of the Palestinian enclaves. Another term that I will never use is an illegal building, Palestinian illegal building, or Palestinian illegal Palestinian worker. The buildings that are being demolished by Israel in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, for having failed to get an Israeli license, a construction license, I mean, the very system is illegal. So how can I talk about the refusal of this illegal system to give a license, a building license? So at most I will write without a permit or but usually I say that the Israelis have a policy to of not allowing Palestinians to develop and build, and that's why they demolish. I don't have to attribute it to the legality or illegality of the building. And of course, Palestinian illegal worker, there are no illegal people, know here, there are no illegal people. They are maybe undocumented, but it's not about being illegal. Then I will not use words that, because they are so often repeated, they flatten the meaning. Occupation. I think it is an accurate description of many things. There is a military occupation. Everything in the West Bank, and even in Gaza, is run by military orders of the occupying party. But people have gotten so accustomed to this that it doesn't seem anymore to the readers as an unusual thing, or as an illegal phenomenon, phenomenon because it lasts for so long. It doesn't convey the whole message of Israeli domination. So I would say domination and control about every detail in people's lives. So I will find other, like I will say domination, I will say this Israeli interference, military interference in everyday life. I will say Israeli military violence, or bureaucratic violence. This is something that I often say. Violence is not only by guns, violence is also, and very often mostly the bureaucratic violence that is used by Israeli authorities. For example, permits. The issuance of permits or no permits. Another word which I refrain from using is victims. Sometimes, oftentimes, people put it as a to show the dichotomy, the terrible dichotomy, and to show who is the weak party and who is the strong party, and then we make victimhood as an identity of a people, not as a description of a situation and of a policy, but the onus is getting on the shoulders of the people who are under occupation. So I here also I'm kind of making some nerves in order not to use the term. And sometimes, on the contrary, I repeat sentences that I know that I wrote them a million times before, and I will write them another million times. For example, I will always say that the closure on Gaza started on 15th of January 1991. Because many sides want to say that the closure started in 2007 or 2006 or 2000. Bullshit. It started before Oslo. It started before the Palestinian suicide attacks. It started as part of a policy to separate Gaza from the West Bank and to foil a solution that was then still seen as possible and was possible. And this is the establishment of a Palestinian state, as agreed by the international community and Palestinians themselves in the 67 occupied territory. I will also always mention Israeli domination over 60% of the land in the West Bank and including Jerusalem. I will always say Area C, 60, 61, 62% of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. I repeat this like a parrot. And I know that people notice that I repeat it. And I will always mention the original villages and cities from which Palestinians came from 48. Another solution to my problem of the routine will be to change the style. So not to use the same style and to jump from sometimes I write news and in the kind of detached language of the news, and sometimes it will be a personal column where I can use some irony or be more even poetic sometimes. But then I ask myself, concentrating on the style and putting energy and thought into the right style, which means paying attention to the aesthetics of the product. Is it not a narcissistic engagement? Do I not fall here into this trap of self-indulgence in the style as an object instead on the content? It's a problem. The aesthetization is always a problem, especially for a journalist. And then I feel with all this looking for the solutions for my dilemmas or for the remedies for my dilemmas, I find myself even disgusted by words, you know, and I'm jealous with anybody who can express themselves by other tools, not verbal. Or I feel I want a big stick and then I want to break things. But the ethical dilemmas, the real ethical dilemmas that accompany my work are being dwarfed the stylistic dilemmas are being dwarfed in comparison to the ethical dilemmas of my work as a journalist. And this is a thing that I was aware of from the beginning, but with time it's more acute, or maybe I dare to voice them. The main dilemma which has accompanied me from the start, and I think because I come from a left-wing background and I was an activist before I became a journalist activist, so to whom is my main commitment? To whom am I to what am I mostly obliged? To journalistic accuracy and truth, or to the struggle against occupation? So very often the two overlap. I mean, the truth and the fight against occupation overlap. But there are times when I'm at work and I encounter phenomena that that deserve being reported on, but they are problematic. And I'll give you several examples, not all that I have. I'll give them maybe the most extreme example, but this in order to portray the gravity of this dilemma. At the beginning of the second Intifada, a very good source of mine in Gaza, I mean, I knew that everything that they told me was very accurate. So someone of my friends in Rafah informed when there were killings, the Israeli army would always report about clashes, and I knew that this friend would tell me exactly if somebody was killed in a clash of gunmen, I mean, Israelis and Palestinians, or a civilian who was killed by Israelis. And he described the situation of one person walking in the streets Salah ad-Din, and a shot comes from a watchtower in a distance of half a kilometer or 1 kilometer, and the man falls down. And he says his name is Iyad. And then another person, let's say his name is Riyad, going to rescue, and another shot hits the second person, Riyad. And my friend repeats the names. And then he said, and another person comes, and my friend says, but this you don't write. His name is Hitler. He comes to the rescue of the second of the two others. So this exposed me to a phenomenon, not very large one, but there are Palestinians who are named officially Hitler. I know one who is Eichmann too. And and there are Rommels and others, but there are some of them who are Hitlers. And here it's clear, the answer is clear. If I wrote the name Hitler, nobody would have noticed that two people who were not involved in anything were walking in the street and were killed. They were killed, he was wounded. So of course, I mean, I didn't have any doubt that I shouldn't mention his name. But there are other, you know, there are occasions when I go and I cover events and I hear Palestinians say something like, oh, the Jews were so filthy in Europe that they had to be isolated. You know, a sentence that comes from a Nazi, anti-Semitic film or book or something. And I heard it in Hebron under the worst conditions of Israeli attacks against Palestinians. And I heard it similar things near checkpoints where people were kept for hours and in pouring rain were kept for hours. And I heard it in a refugee camp before a funeral of one of some kids who were killed by the Israelis. So here again, even though I think it is a phenomenon that has to be addressed, but not in these circumstances. And this is, of course, some kind of an extreme, but I do say that my first loyalty is to writing about Israeli occupation. This is my first and foremost responsibility. Then what I deduct and what I can write and say about Palestinian society comes in a different, in other occasions, and never will I incriminate a person by connecting the person or the circumstances to some things that have been said like this about Hitler. This is something that I learned from the start, that Israeli authorities can be very, very vengeful. And when I get information, real information from Palestinians, I have to make sure that disclosing their names would not harm them. And very often I say, okay, so I just don't mention the name. I know it's against many, the rules of the New York Times. But I often say, I have two sources, Allah and Arafat. Now that Arafat is gone, Allah remained. So that's... I'll skip some of the dilemmas and come to the last one. Being 25, one of the things that I'm happy with that I lived in Gaza and that I know that I have friends there in Gaza that knew me from before I became so famous. So they know that I'm the same as I was. But because Haaretz is published in English, has been published in English since the mid-90s, and then because of the internet, etc., so we have no choice but become famous. And we become famous, we Israeli journalists, also because there is more credibility. I mean, this Western credibility, the credibility that the West gives to what Israelis write, more than to what Palestinians write. Even though I know, my information comes from Palestinians, I know that I have to work hard in order to get the accurate, because normal people, I don't have relations with authorities. So ordinary people, if they describe, so each one has an angle, but people do not lie as a rule. And whatever people tell me, whatever I learned about Israeli policies is from people, Palestinians. And they are accurate. I mean, they are... and I can reach this accuracy through talking to people. So why do they need me? Why does the world need me to write about occupation when Palestinians say that? And tell about it for so long. You know, when we look at the testimonies of breaking the silence of soldiers, and it's a very important project, but one of the things that they discovered, and I'll tell you silently that this is something that I told them from the start, it only proves how for years Palestinians were saying the same thing, but nobody listened to them. So don't I collaborate with this, actually, with this unjust and hegemonic attitude that what's credible is what we, the whites or the Jews, say, and not what Palestinians. There is a sense of, there is a risk of appropriating the stories or the testimonies of the Palestinians and using them for our career. So actually making us, in a way, profit from the occupation as well. And this is a dilemma, and I must say that I don't have a solution to it, and I, other than sharing it with others. Thank you.
I want to start by reading a very small poem. Jerusalem. In the old city, grocers scoop rice and wheat from huge sacks, pour grain into deep brass scales, measure anise and cardamom and thyme. When sun slips into the pans, it's swept up without charge, the way you don't pay for the fragrance of coffee, Zatar's bright swirl of sumac. Not like the mass of sorrow weighting the air beneath the odor of cumin that tips the scales in every reckoning. I have to admit that when I started trying to think about what I would say on the topic of this panel, I felt completely stymied. What is, in fact, the ability of literature to respond to the realities of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict when those realities seem so grim and unrelenting? There are times, like yesterday, when I learned that there was again bombing on the Gaza border and people were again fleeing their homes, when I find myself wondering about the usefulness of any words, perhaps especially artistic words, in the face of violence. Violence reduces our voices to shocked fragments of language, or to stunned silence. In order for words to have meaning, we need a baseline of physical safety, bodies that are unharmed, homes that can still offer shelter. The philosopher Elaine Scarry has written movingly about the ways in which violence and pain silence our human capacity for articulation, or reduce our voices to a scream of anguish. As a writer trying to respond to an ongoing situation of dehumanization and violence with no apparent end in sight, there are times when silence or a scream seem the only possibilities. That was certainly the case for me during the 2014 war on Gaza, when I found myself able to write almost nothing but a terse piece recording the conversations I was having with supporters of the war, who stunned me by finding increasingly insidious ways to rationalize the violence. The poem includes the line taken almost verbatim from one of my interlocutors: "There are no children in Gaza, only young combatants." But literature insists on our capacity for voice. It affirms the need to speak out, to resist the silencing power of violence, and also to assert both simple humanity and the right to an ordinary life. This kind of resistance is typified, for instance, in Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish's famous early poem, "Write Down, I Am an Arab," as well as in his later, more complex interrogations of the power and powerlessness of language, as in his lines, "We have a country of words, speak, speak, so we may know the end of this travel." As Darwish's line suggests, the problem is not just to find voice, but to claim a space in which to speak. As Edward Said memorably noted, Palestinians have long been denied the most basic condition of articulation, permission to narrate. In Palestine, writers have historically tried to avoid censorship by using metaphor and imagery to disguise their political statements. Even the Palestinian-American poet Naomi Shihab Nye describes having a poem she wrote during the First Intifada about a young Palestinian girl shot in the face by a soldier when she looked out of her window, presented an Arabic translation to the Israeli military censor, returned, stamped, "Rejected entirely," in red. Ironically, the poem contained the line, quote, "When do we become doctors for one another, Arab, Jew, instead of guarding tumors of pain as if they hold us upright?" The censors apparently considered this a subversive statement. But literature affirms, too, a measure of hope. Hope that the words will be heard. Hope that they will create meaning. Hope that something will change, even if only the awareness of the reader. At the very least, literature opens a space for questions without which there can be no answers. For me, writing poetry has always served as a way both to claim a space in the world and to speak out against the events and forces that deny this space to so many. My own entry to writing about the conflict as a young woman was sparked by a powerful confluence between personal and political: the eruption of the First Intifada and my Palestinian father's death a few months later. My father's passing spurred me to take stock of his life, including what it had meant for him to have lived as a Palestinian in exile, and my own relation to that history. Meanwhile, the uprising spilling onto my TV screen every night and the heated debate about it made it impossible to stay silent. I needed a way to state, with both simplicity and complexity, what seemed to have been erased from public consciousness, that Palestinians are people, possessing, like other people, depths of experience, identity, community, history, and rights, and like other people, suffering pain, experiencing despair, and holding on to hope. As a writer and a person, I've always found it difficult to separate my personal experiences from the political facts that have shaped them. I write out of a bifurcated identity. My father was a Palestinian from Jerusalem who was not allowed to return to his home after 1948, and went to the U.S., where he met and married my American mother. So my very existence is a result of Palestinian exile. Similarly, the most private of my emotions and experiences have been inherently politicized. From my grief in my 20s over my failed attempt to bury my father in Palestine, his deepest wish — we could not get permission from the Israeli authorities to bring his body across the border — to the experience of growing up with cousins whom I thought when I was young were my grandmother's children, learning only much later that they were motherless because my aunt had been killed by an Irgun terrorist at a Jerusalem bus stop in 1948. Even my personal identity conflicts have been brought into stark relief by political events, such as when the boat I fled the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon on was arrested by the Israeli Navy and taken to Israel for interrogation, where I felt myself in front of the Israeli soldier interrogating me, at once threatened by my Palestinian identity and protected by my American identity. The poems and essays I first wrote explored connections between my personal and family experiences and the larger communal and political issues situating them, the dispossession and occupation shaping the lives of all Palestinians, whether inside or outside Palestine. I grappled with an older generation's longing for Palestine, with the reality of young people risking their lives to protest oppression, and with my own uneasy place in a world where I felt, no matter where I was, always other. I wrote both to claim a space for myself and to provide a glimpse of the human impact of the conflict on ordinary people, and to do so in a voice that I hoped would be heard. The process of writing also provided a means by which to question reductive views of the conflict that insisted on stark portrayals of black and white. My own experience had taught me that borders are never so neat. Human realities, by their very nature, cross lines of culture and religion and history and geography and identity and politics to touch what is common to all of us. And the issues at stake in this conflict encompass not just matters of opposing identity and politics and land, but fundamentally the simplest of human experiences and human rights. Perhaps because the main elements of the poetic process include attention to detail and an ability to make connections, poetry has always seemed to me particularly suited to the task of exploring the complex relationship between facts and their reverberations, political events and the people who live through them. Against the mind-numbing devastation of news headlines and military strikes, a poem can present potent glimpses of the human beings affected: a father killed on his doorstep, a pregnant woman shot at a checkpoint, a boy killed by a sniper on his way to school. As such, poetry has the capacity to bring a human face to the facelessness of violence, making it harder to excuse or ignore the obliteration of human beings. But it does so not simply by exposition, but also by evocation, allowing linguistic resonance and imagery and form to participate in conveying meaning. This is true not only of quieter work, but also pieces written out of great emotion, as a scream of protest or a cry of despair. Even the most political of poems for me tends to originate from a confluence of intellectual and emotional and sensory input, an emotion, an image, a fragment of language, and not a line from a news report, a splintered memory. The process of exploring the reverberations of these fragments offers an invitation first to the artist and then to the reader to follow step by step into territory that may be familiar or deeply unfamiliar. The process thus opens a space for shifts in perception, empathy, and perhaps even in identification, the ability to see oneself on the other side of the dividing line or in the place of another and to ask, could I accept this for myself? And if not, how can this be changed? The kind of subtle questioning and empathetic engagement that can be achieved through this kind of evocative association offers the possibility, I hope, one hopes, I'm being a bit more hopeful than I really think, but I'm trying hard, of inviting readers to engage with aspects of the conflict that are the most contested. For instance, in a poem I wrote about my family's experience of taking the body of a great aunt, whom we call Teta Bahia, back to Palestine for burial, in this case successfully, although the body was treated horrifically at the border. It was dumped out of the coffin and the cavities were... Anyway, I found myself exploring not only the individual experience, but its broader implications. The process of writing led me toward an intuitive understanding of the longing of an older generation for the homeland they had lost, and to an understanding, too, of the intrinsic violence of the events that had not only dispossessed them, but kept them out even after death. In the poem, Bahia's connection to plants and to earth, like her love for the apricot seeds I remembered her cracking and eating, emerged as an emblem of continuity and connection, an evocation of the ways in which memory lives within us, waiting to break to light. This dovetailed with the longing I had heard voiced in my childhood, at least to be buried there in Palestine, and came together in a metaphorical linkage of buried bones and planted seeds waiting to sprout to light. As such, the poem subtly addressed one of the most charged of Palestinian claims, the right of return, a claim that is not only emotional, but for stateless refugees, some now seeking refuge from other wars, still urgently real. I did not set out to write a poem about the right of return, but in the process of telling a human story, the issue emerged metaphorically, its reverberations extending both into the past and the future. And in the poem, I shift into the in the last stanza from a third-person narration to a second-person address. And by doing this, I wanted the poem to invite the reader not only to listen empathetically to one person's story, but to understand it from within a space of communal involvement. Although in my earlier work I often wrote from personal experience, my later work engaged with events I only knew through news reports, with the voices and consciousnesses of people whose experiences I could only imagine. There's an issue at stake here, but I do this to respond to what is going on in the world. I am not there, but I am so deeply affected by everything that happens in the news. I feel like that my skin has been flayed half the time. And I wanted to both engage myself with what was happening, what is happening, what continues to happen day after day and year after year and decade after decade, but also to invite a reader to find points of connection to the experiences of people to whom they too had no relationship. For instance, in trying to write about the 2006 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, a war that sent me into a spiral of anguish because it both awoke memories of my own experiences during the 1982 invasion and because I knew so many people in danger there, I found myself struggling to find an adequate vehicle through which to grapple with the scale of the violence. This was especially true after I saw a photo of a mass grave, a long trench with coffins of many different sizes, adult and child-sized, waiting to be buried, lined up like a jagged line of broken teeth on the grave's edge. The swirl of emotion which that photo triggered in me centered on the understanding that, as Lebanese-American writer Etel Adnan has put it, it is not that there are millions of deaths. Rather, it happens millions of times that someone, a person, a human being in whose consciousness and memory and experience an entire world is crystallized, dies. How does one engage with so many lives, so many deaths? The poem that I wrote emerged in the voice of a Lebanese coffin maker, overwhelmed by the task of building coffins as the death toll rises, who focuses on the details of his work to keep emotion at bay long enough to do his job. Moving into this persona provided me with an entry point to the war's devastation, a way to understand the cost not just for the dead, but for the living. The poem's first-person narration, similarly, I hoped, would challenge readers to undertake an empathetic leap, to become a listener as well as a participant, and to engage on a personal level with the human impact of war instead of dismissing casualties as an unfortunate necessity or not seeing them at all. This kind of personal engagement with other people's experiences has always seemed to me an urgency if we are to move beyond a situation where the human worth of some is taken as self-evident while the human worth of others is erased, in which pacification is substituted for peace and we are expected not to notice the difference. Anyone who discusses Israel-Palestine will have encountered the mind-whirling view that to claim equivalence of human rights is cheeky or sacrilegious, or that the suffering of some is more important than the suffering of others. The process of dehumanization, which does occur to some extent on all sides, but it's very clear what's happening, both underlies the conflict and perpetuates it. Dehumanization also depends on degradation of language. During the 2002 destruction of the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank, the media questioned whether the event constituted a massacre or not. And you have that poem in the handout that I gave you. It's a poem called This Is Not a Massacre, the one that I'm referring to. I'll get to it. By dismissing the word massacre as inapplicable to Palestinian deaths, not only was the atrocity of loss of life diminished, language itself was distorted. Similarly, after a bombing of a Gaza apartment building in 2006 that killed many civilians, official reports tried to rationalize the devastation by terming it a technical failure, terrible accident, unfortunate event, regrettable but necessary. When viewed in conjunction with the reality, the litany of official excuses seemed a distortion almost as grotesque as the body parts piled up in the streets. In any case, obfuscating language does not change the reality. The dead are still dead, and the dead cannot make peace. In poems responding to these events, one is this is not a massacre, which you have, I tried to challenge, through irony among other means, this Orwellian use of language to rationalize violence and obscure the human lives destroyed by it. One of the things that poetry's attention to the detail of human experience does is to challenge the subversion of human empathy. In order to engage empathetically with the experience of another, even quite small points of connection will do. In one poem narrating a Palestinian woman's life under occupation, My entry point was a line I read in an interview with international solidarity movement activists, that Palestinian children don't have snow days, they have military invasion days. I was at the time a somewhat harried mother of young children, and the comment not only put my own experience into perspective, but reminded me how slim a line exists between the lives we take for granted and the normalization of violence. What would it be like to be raising my children under such conditions, I wondered. The mother in the poem, which is the other poem that I've given you as a handout, the mother in the poem tells her children to make their beds, hang the laundry, go outside and play. Simple instructions that any of us might give our children. But in an indication of how occupation distorts the very fabric of ordinary life, she also warns them to avoid making eye contact when military jeeps go past, refrain from picking up stones for hopscotch, lest they be arrested as stone throwers, scrub political graffiti off the walls before soldiers see it, and keep out of the way of settlers with guns. By situating the daily experience of parenting within the realities of military occupation, I wanted the poem to provide a glimpse of ordinary life under conditions that should never have become ordinary. And I wanted it to provide a space for the mother's own voice, her own words, and her own humanity. And I titled the poem, What She Said. The need to lay claim to a space in which to speak was brought home to me with particular urgency during Israel's 50-year anniversary in 1998. I was still living in the States at that time. What struck me most was not the celebrations of Israel's half-century of existence filling the U.S. media, but the complete absence of any parallel acknowledgement of what had been done to Palestinians in the process, any recognition that the dark underside of Israeli statehood was the Nakba. In a long poem titled 50 Years On, Stones in an Unfinished Wall, I attempted to challenge the silencing of history, to make room for the experiences of those exiles for whom there was no more space in history, no page for the story. In the poem, I allowed fragments of historical and journalistic fact and personal experience and memory and natural imagery to come together in a tilting structure that spilled across the page, evoking echoes of the low stone walls that dot the landscape of Palestine and articulate, humbly but with tenacity, the relationship between the people and the land, or stones in a mosaic, a fractured form that brings together splintered bits into a larger whole. In the poem, I drew verbatim on the language of historical and journalistic sources, in part because in that context of silencing, it seemed necessary to prevent factual proof of the stories that were missing, affirmation that the experiences that had shaped not only my life, but the life of an entire people, had in fact happened. But how can one restore history? It can never be done wholesale unless through violence, as the history of this conflict has grimly shown. As a result, the poem could not remain rooted in historical fact alone. It needed to open itself to emotional reverberations of the past, but also of the future, of despair, but also of some kind of hope. As such, it sought to move imaginatively into a space in which the enormity of loss, the resistance to erasure, and the longing for continuity could be articulated through imagery that was non-literal in its scope, gesturing beyond the closed-down future. The poem ends by imagining the lingering echoes of the people who built the homes now destroyed, the walls now torn down, but who still hold on to memories of continuity. And the poem ends with the line, "How stone holds dew through the night, how stone waits for the thirsty birds." And in thinking about what poetry can do, how it can actually respond to this conflict, I find myself coming back to the fact that poetry can evoke the humanism, which is the humanism of the people who are enduring, the humanism of the people who are living this, but it still tries to offer hope. No matter how hopeless the situation is, no matter how dark the situation is, if we give up hope, we stop writing, we stop speaking. If we give up hope, it's very hard to have a voice of any kind whatsoever. I don't know if hope is realistic, and I suspect not. But without it, no words, and perhaps no future is possible. I want to end by reading a poem that I wrote during the Second Intifada, after a bus bombing in which many Israelis were killed. It was, not for the first time, a time when words seemed almost useless, and the poem's stunned fragments of language reflect this. But the poem also tried to find a way to speak beyond the impasse of violence, evoking both the baseline elements needed for peace and the possibility, no matter how attenuated, of sustaining at least the hope of hope. The poem is called Rain. fragments of bone stuck to balconies. The word made flesh, breath splintered like shrapnel, impossible to speak beyond the bodies. How a word transforms us, seedling taking delicate hold, or a weed choking the tender plants. News enters us and puts down roots. We plant grief, drench it with our tears, it will not grow. The dead can't shield themselves, the useless petals of their hands, outflung hands. What weapon can silence a million birds crying at dawn for the sun? We have unlearned how to speak to one another. Torn to flesh, what words can mend us? You cry, give us peace. We cry, give us our lives. Peace grows like any other plant on the land. It needs earth and water. Our words flower from fragile bodies, sway on slender stalks, mouths tilted upward for the rain. Thank you.
You have been listening to Israeli journalist Amira Haas and Palestinian poet Lisa Majaj speaking at a forum in Boston sponsored by Consequence magazine. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will feature a presentation by local activist Nancy Murray, who recently returned from her 13th trip to Gaza. That is next week on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.